I am both, and I am neither. We are Aaron Bjarkthen. We exist because two minds chose it to be so. Perhaps we all have that in common, at least.
The audience was silent, each member waiting for someone else to decide how they were supposed to be reacting.
We know what you think of us,
continued Aaron Bjarkthen dreamily, one tentacle idly stroking the top of the mic stand.
You look at us and you see an alien creature taking over the body of an impressionable young man, deleting his mind. We don't fully understand our nature ourselves, but there are some things that we are certain of. We know Aaron is still here, because Aaron can think in ways that Bjarkthen cannot. Thoughts of wonder, of sadness, of joy.
He turned his gaze upwards.
When we remember Bjarkthen's world, the cold brilliance of the formless colours arcing across space, it is Aaron who feels wonder. It is Aaron's sadness when we think of the eternal conflicts of the ancients, the reasons for their animosity long forgotten, and how pointless it all seems from the safety of our existence here. And through Aaron, Bjarkthen knows joy. Joy at the simplest things of this earthly realm. Like the unquestioned love between a brother and sister.
At the back of the seating section, standing in the buffer zone between the journalists and the students, Victor Kaysen made an unimpressed little puff, audible only to Adam Hesketh. I wish he'd lay it on a bit thicker. My heart's only grown two sizes so far.
Shh, hissed Adam. Don't tell me you're not finding this interesting.
Yeah, I could have gotten possessed. Then I could have started doing beat poetry as well, once Ifrig was done burning everyone.
Less of the muttering, said Richard Danvers, sliding neatly into the space between the two agents. He kept his gaze trained on the stage as he spoke through the sides of his mouth. Everything fine out here?
All quiet so far, said Victor.
Oh, except we did run into Mike Badger,
whispered Adam quickly.
Danvers boggled. Where? Just here, before the show. I don't see him now.
I'll look around. Keep this quiet and be prepared for anything. He began to awkwardly sidle away.
Badger, Jesus. Did you deliberately tell me this now because you knew I wouldn't be able to shout?
69. Alison burst into the kitchen at full sprint, making Archibald Brooks Dodgley freeze, with a cup of tea in his hand and a biscuit pressed guiltily to his lips. She grabbed the edge of the preparation table for want of an emergency break.
What do you mean?
She blasted out, urgently. Archibald's lips moved uncertainly around the edge of the biscuit for a moment before he lowered it.
What are you trying to say, my dear?
Alison took a deep breath, waved a hand in a rhythmic motion for a few seconds, then tried again.
What does excessive sweating mean?
Alison, why don't you take a seat and calm down? I'm sure whatever is distressing you.
She pulled out the chair beside Archibald with a loud scrape and plonked herself down with a violence she would be feeling in her tailbone for the rest of the week.
Please, what does it mean when someone sweats too much?
He looked around, an embarrassed smile threatening to cross his face.
That they're anxious or embarking upon strenuous exercise?
He made a mollifying gesture as her head dropped in exasperation.
Oh, I see, you meant in a magical context. Well, supernatural sweating is a top priority infusion signal.
Alison brushed the hair out of her eyes.
Seriously?
Oh, yes, if a person is sweating to the point of implausibility, in that they're producing more sweat than their body should realistically be able to produce, then that's manifestation. Creating something from nothing. One of the most powerful categories of infusion.
Seriously?
Repeated Alison, unable to think of a better response.
Well, I'm sure it's being created from something.
Archibald scratched his head.
It's probably drawing matter from the ether or from subatomic particles or some such. Actually, there's a wizard in Zurich who did an experiment.
But it's just sweating,
said Alison weakly. Archibald frowned at her blank expression, then tutted tolerantly.
Oh, dear, we've gotten the usual wrong idea about magic infusions, haven't we? It's not like there's a lottery machine in the sky handing out specific powers like in your X-Men comics. Infusions are an evolving thing.
He repositioned in his chair to put himself in professorial mode, chubby hands pressed together to wave around and thrust for emphasis.
These odd restrictions that infusion powers seem to have, like that Kaysen fellow only being able to create fire. Most of them are psychosomatic. With the right training and conditioning, there's no reason he shouldn't be able to freeze things as well, or create electrical charges. It's all energy manipulation.
Allison considered the possible results of Victor having that level of power to play with, and shuddered.
I see.
Of course, retraining gets harder the older you get, continued Archibald, sensing her line of thinking. I assume fire happened to be the first trick he figured out, so he fixated on it. Built too many pathways in his brain by now, it'd probably take years for him to pick that apart.
Allison stared into space. I had no idea. They never told me this at the school. Here, I mean.
Infusion control is very much secondary school turf, said Archibald, nodding. The obvious next stage for a supernatural sweater would be water elementalism. But again, with training, that can become any power from the manifestation spectrum. If what they're producing is actually sweat, chemically speaking, then they could also manifest everything else that makes up sweat, like...
The realization sank from Allison's throat and landed in her bowels with a clang. It swung back and forth like a pendulum that dug into the sides of her gut with her every thudding heartbeat. Salt, she concluded, sweating quite copiously herself. 70. When Allison returned to the backstage area, Aaron Bjarkthen was still on stage, describing Bjarkthen's colourful memories of the ethereal realm to an enraptured audience. To Allison's partial relief, Jessica was still there, waiting near the curtains with eyes on phone. Elizabeth and Anderson had risen from the basement and were watching the speech through the small gap in the curtains. Both stood with arms folded and lips pursed, like a couple refusing to talk after an argument. Nita Pavani stood stiffly between them, hands before her mouth as if in prayer, eyes glued to Aaron Bjarkthen. The three of them resembled a statue of a Christian martyr between two Easter Island heads. Allison confirmed that Shugshuthuks was still hanging around the door to the basement stairs, relishing his independence, then crept up to the group.
"Where are the other fluidics?" she whispered.
"Green room,"
muttered Anderson. "Some litter was laid out in the entrance hall for them to eat," elaborated Elizabeth. "They're there with Woolston now." Allison glanced back at Jessica, who still hadn't moved. Reassured, she inwardly chanted the words, "casual, friendly, not suspicious," in her head as she made the long, terrifying walk across the room. "Jessica?" She glanced up. Her usual blank look was now, to Allison, the emotionless stare of a ruthless killer.
"Hmm? Could I borrow you for a moment?"
Allison put one hand on her hip in an attempt to stop them nervously jiggling from side to side. "I just need to talk about something. In private." Jessica glanced towards the stage curtains. Aaron Bjarkthen's powers of speech seemed to have momentarily faltered, perhaps running low on ethereal realm anecdotes.
"I think we're supposed to get reunited soon."
"It'll only take a minute, promise?" Jessica shrugged and followed Allison to the basement stairs. Within moments, she had brought her phone out again and was staring at it as she walked. Behind them, Aaron Bjarkthen found a second wind, and their eldritch voice continued to float across the silence like a boat on a calm sea. 71. In the dungeon, Allison held open the door to cell 5. "Just in here," she said. "I need you to..." On the way down the stairs, she had come up with a cunning lie to get Jessica into the cell that she was quietly proud of, so she was slightly disappointed when Jessica wandered straight in without so much as a glance up. But Allison wasn't about to raise a fuss about it. She slammed the door closed and fumbled for the deadbolt. When her shaking fingers had finally slid it home, a blanket of relief settled on her so heavily that her legs very nearly gave out. That was the easy part out of the way. The fluidics were safe. Things would only get tricky again when she went back upstairs and had to explain to her colleagues that they were going to need a new main event on the fly. She looked over at the door to cell 6, where Diablerie was still contained. Well, she thought, still buzzing from adrenaline, now that we're in, might as well be in all the way. She slid back the bolt on cell 6. Diablerie had been sitting on the side of his bed with his arms around his stomach, hunched so far forward that his cheeks were resting on his knees. He looked up when the door opened, and an instant later was upright and posing impressively. Then his neck began to loll, and he promptly collapsed into Allison's arms.
"Aha!" he slurred, muffled by her shoulder. "What futile torments am I to defy now, lackey of Lawrence? Peanut butter can be used to counteract biological weapons."
She was able to smoothly pivot on one foot and prop him up against the door. "It's all right," she said. "I know you're not the fluidic killer. Jessica Weatherby's the fluidic killer." He squinted, struggling to focus on her face.
"Is she?"
"You already knew, right?" said Allison, leaning exhaustedly on the doorframe. "The fluidic killer strikes again. That's what you said when you showed up here. But you weren't talking about yourself."
"That's certainly one interpretation," said Diablerie warily.
"And we talked about her sweating back in Doncaster. You know that that can lead to salt elementalism, right?"
"What an intriguing logical path you seem to have taken."
Diablerie straightened up into his condescending pose, keeping one hand on the wall to steady himself.
"But presume not to dictate to Diablerie what Diablerie knows, girl. The full extent of what Diablerie knows would overflow that cavernous mind of yours with thorns and blood.
So you seek to enlist Diablerie in the mending of this affair?"
"No, it's all right," said Allison, sliding to the floor. "Everything's sorted out now. I've already got Jessica in the next cell. The fluidics are safe."
"Well, as long as the mildew stains are safe."
He tottered past her, keeping one hand on the wall as he went, and pressed his eye against the peephole in door 5.
"Hmm," he said, after a pause. "This affair may not be as fully mended as you imagine it to be, girl."
Allison tensed.
"What?" "There's nobody in there."
Diablerie politely stood aside as Allison rapidly rose and flew to the peephole as if she were being drawn in by a high-powered winch.
"Yes, there,"
she began, when she saw Jessica standing in the middle of the cell, but her words swiftly died. Now that Diablerie had planted the seed of doubt, the illusion began to break. The edges of Jessica's image flickered and lost focus, like there was a drop of water on the peephole, or like one of Aaron Weatherby's illusions. The image of Jessica promptly vanished. Either Aaron Bjarkthen had somehow realized that the game was up, or becoming aware of the trick had reinforced Allison's senses against it. There was something inside Diablerie's mind that blocked telepaths and drove them insane. Did that same something make him immune to illusions? If a fire power can be retrained into an ice power, then telepathy and illusions were probably from the same group as well. And back when they had first encountered Aaron, hadn't Diablerie walked straight into the Room of Blood without a care in the world? She turned away from the peephole. "Are you?" she said, before discovering that Diablerie had vanished. From above her, she heard a faint round of applause. 72. On stage, Aaron Bjarkthen was hugging Jessica to the delight of an applauding audience. It soon became clear that they were intent on keeping the hug going for as long as the applause did, and the audience were showing no sign of letting them break off. Several photographers were on their feet, competing for the best shot of the moment. One of them, in the fourth row, looked at the screen on the back of his camera, and saw that the picture he'd taken appeared to be of Aaron Bjarkthen standing alone in the middle of the stage, arms embracing empty air. He glanced up, confused, and made eye contact with Aaron Bjarkthen over Jessica's shoulder. There was a flash of something indistinct in Aaron Bjarkthen's discolored eye, and the photographer felt the sensation of a weight settling onto his brain, as if he'd suddenly risen from a hot bath. When he looked down again, the picture was as it should have been, of the Weatherbys hugging. It seemed the color and lighting had been slightly corrected, too. The Weatherbys disentangled, and Jessica came to the microphone stand. "Thank you," she said, as the crowd quietened down. There was a subtle strangeness to the sound of her voice. It was perfectly audible, but at the same time somehow seemed to be coming from a long way away. "I just know with all the people here today, we can make the right kind of impact." The curtains flew apart, and Allison Arkin leapt onto the stage, cracking Aaron Bjarkthen around the head with an iron ladle she had hastily grabbed from the kitchen. He went down, tentacles fluttering like the tail of a comet, and the Jessica phantom disappeared from the senses of every person present. Allison looked up, panting, and met several hundred shocked gazes.
Sorry, she said, unconsciously hiding the ladle behind her back. She wasn't actually real.
An arm like a greasy side of beef appeared through the curtains, fastened around her neck, and gently dragged her back inside. Moments later, Nita Pavani appeared and helped the dazed Aaron Bjarkthen crawl out of sight. "Please don't go anywhere," she called, before disappearing herself.
"What on earth are you doing?" asked Elizabeth, backstage, as Anderson held Allison as inescapably as a roller coaster safety harness.
"That wasn't Jessica,"
gasped Allison, pulling herself up until her mouth was free of Anderson's bicep.
Aaron was creating an illusion.
She's right, you know, said Archibald, who was peering around the stage curtain. I saw her disappear when the boy went down.
So, said Nita angrily, checking Aaron Bjargthen's pupils as he sat against a wall. Just because she's got a little stage fright, that's not an invitation to start braining people. Where is she? She's the fluidic killer!
That gave everyone pause. Anderson's arm untensed, and Alison dropped to the floor, red in the face. Elizabeth knelt beside her. Why do you think that?
She sweats,
sputtered Alison, before taking a vast gulp of air and trying again.
Mr. Brooks Todgley told me. She's got the sweating power, and that means she can create salt.
What? Said Archibald. Is this what you were so worked up about? She can't be the fluidic killer if she's still at the sweating stage.
Alison looked up at him as she felt several angry looks intensifying in her direction.
But I'm sure if our man is a salt elemental, there must have been a sweater at one point, but they'd have left that stage behind long ago. It would take years of practice to have the kind of fine control the fluidic killer has.
Are you sure?
Absolutely, I'd stake my reputation on it. There's no way a sweater could be manifesting like that right out of school.
His expression suddenly changed, brows dropping and mouth pouting thoughtfully. Everyone present kept their eyes on him as they sensed an unless speeding towards his lips.
Unless she's possessed, of course.
73. XX Reva XX. Well, it's been fun, but I'm afraid this is where we part ways. Jess.
Good.
Much as I've enjoyed the pleasure of our company, all these lovely fluidics that have been laid out for me is too good an opportunity to miss. I've been very good at cutting down my murder diet since the first two, so I think I've earned a cheat day. Oh, hell, let's go mad and treat myself to a few in a row. Why not? I'm celebrating.
Just go away.
Hmm? I don't think you've quite grasped the logistics of the situation, dear. Look down. Look at the bottom of the screen. See those thumbs working away at the keypad? They're yours. Your thumbs are typing this. They've always been typing this. But now I'm bored of the joke. There are so many more important things I could be accomplishing with these thumbs. And the rest of you, of course. What's the saying? Change comes from within? I think I speak for all your internal components when I say it's time for a change. Your digestive system is going to scream if it has to process one more delivery pizza. I take it from your silence that you agree. What's that? You think I should take over on a permanent basis? How unexpected. I'm so honoured by your gracious offer, I can only promise to be worthy of it.
74. Can only promise to be worthy of it, read Alison from the smartphone she had found among the half-digested garbage covering the floor of the former green room. A room which was mysteriously devoid of fluidics, but suddenly abundant with tense civil servants, as well as several clumps of magically conjured salt.
Interesting, said Archibald Brooks Dodgley, peering over Alison's shoulder. I don't believe I've ever seen possession like this. I've seen the imaginary friend scenario in children a few times, but never in young adults. Indictment of the generation, perhaps. No offence meant, my dear.
Take her brother into custody, commanded Elizabeth. No, said Nita, protectively moving between her and Aaron Bjargthen. They didn't know about this.
All she told me was she wasn't feeling up to coming on stage,
said Aaron Bjargthen. The human side of his voice was full of innocence and protest, but the other side had the measured tone of a wary gangster in a police interview room. We only have his word for this, said Elizabeth. And another thing, said Nita, placing her hands on hips. Why is it just because we found out Jessica has a dual consciousness, have you all taken this as confirmation that she must be the killer? I think there's some prejudice being laid bare here. The entrance doors flew open and Richard Danvers entered, with Kaysen and Hesketh trailing behind like baby ducks following their mother. Several other department agents were visible in the courtyard outside, asking each other if they knew what was going on. I've just been informed, said Danvers with military urgency. Any sign of where they went? Not yet, said Elizabeth, nodding meaningfully to Hesketh. Realizing his cue, Adam took on the slightly idiotic squint that meant he was turning his extra senses up to full power.
Got something? Definitely the same signal I was picking up back at the mine?
Where? Asked Danvers. Adam looked confused for a moment, his eyes following the curves of an invisible shape, before his gaze settled on a nearby broom cupboard. He walked over, nodded meaningfully to Victor, then threw the door open. Henry Woolston was as firmly sealed within a column of magically conjured salt as an expensive action figure in plastic packaging. He was suspended a foot off the ground in the midst of a cluster of glistening white spikes and cylinders, all his hands and feet fully encased. The crystals that held his neck in place extended around to the front of his face and filled his mouth entirely. His eyes were wide and frightened, and he was attempting to bellow through his nose. Victor clapped his hands to dispel the flames he had prepared. "Someone's gonna need a glass of water."
"Now this is what I call fine control," said Archibald admiringly, rubbing the end of an extruding salt stalagmite between his fingers. "Hey, Liz, just to let you know, I'm willing to take command of the situation," said Anderson, hands behind back, "if you don't think your lot are up to it."
Alison realized that her time with Deeda had made her more cynical, because she picked up on the subtext of the offer even before he waggled his eyebrows. Elizabeth gave him a brief blast of her most scornful look, then turned to Danvers. "Send agents with Hesketh, follow her trail and stop her." "If it is her," added Nita. "Take Kaysen, Black and Rawlins," said Danvers to Adam, pointing to the relevant agents like a conductor. "Tell everyone else to shore up the perimeter on the grounds. Don't let anyone in or out. And if you find the girl with the fluidics, do whatever you have to do to protect them." "If they need protecting," said Nita, stepping forward as Hesketh's party turned to leave. "In fact, make sure to open some kind of dialogue before you do anything, and consider the larger societal context of her actions." "Use your discretion," translated Danvers. "Got it," said Victor as the agents left, squeezing a surprisingly large amount of sarcasm into two words. Danvers turned to Elizabeth. "I'll go outside and supervise the perimeter. What are you going to do?" "I'll stay with the brother," she replied, offering Aaron Bjarkthen a brief look that made his tentacles draw up like the legs of a defensive spider. "There may be further insights to be gained on Jessica's condition." "Then I'll help you," said Nita sharply, stepping up until she was almost chest to chest with the other woman, "in case you forget to write them down." "As you wish." Danvers cocked an ear. The distant murmur from the crowd in the playing field had been growing in volume and was starting to graduate from a murmur to a rumble. "Someone's going to have to distract the media." Anderson clapped his hands with a noise like sudden thunder.
"Ah, the call of destiny. Leave it to me, big man. This is my specialty."
He snapped his fingers towards Allison.
"You, ladle girl, find the nearest off-license and bring back 6 crates of the first thing you can find with a German-sounding name."
75. Alison bounded down the steps from the entrance door into the monastery courtyard, keys at the ready. But when she was halfway to her hired car, she was stopped in her tracks by a familiar smell, one reminiscent of a goat throwing up over a pile of grass clippings. She followed her nose and saw a brown trail leading north from the monastery. The school was largely protected from prying eyes by wild forest, but on the north side there was only a few hundred yards of rolling grassy hills before the rocky Devonshire coastline crashed spectacularly into the Bristol Channel. Alison could see a fluidic making its way up the first slope, a fluidic she had now learned to recognise as her fluidic. Shugshathuks could slither at a decent pace, so by the time Alison had entered conversation range, he was close to the top of the hill. "Shugshathuks!" she called. He continued slithering, showing no sign of acknowledgement. There was an anxious quiver to his movement. Alison had to jog alongside him to keep up. "Dennis?" she tried. If anything, he started moving even faster. She ran ahead a few steps and planted her feet firmly in his path. "What are you doing?" Dennis Shathuks finally stopped and began to cringe and fold himself the way a human would fidget with a crumpled tissue while trying to explain why they've been crying.
"I've been very bad," he said.
"What do you mean?"
"I was being an individual, and now I've lost the others."
He attempted to move around her, but she sidestepped back into his path.
"The others have been taken by the fluidic killer."
"Yes, I know."
He made another failed attempt to slip past, then tried to go between her legs, but she smartly snapped the heels of her trainers together.
"I shall get taken by Shugshathuks too. I've been very bad."
"It's not Shugshathuks, it's Jessica Weatherby," insisted Alison. Dennis finally stopped and curved the centre part of his mass up and back until it was as coiled as a question mark.
"Were we?"
"Yes."
"How do you know?"
Alison produced Jessica's phone. Look! She's been talking to her ancient without realizing it. It's got salt elemental powers. It must have been taking over her body to do the murders.
Shugtathux cocked his mask curiously.
Why'd she give you her phone?
She didn't.
Her statement was sidetracked by a blossoming thought. Why had Jessica dropped her phone? Alison had seen plenty of films and video games where characters left trails of devices and diaries, all conveniently displaying the most recent, most relevant contents for the benefit of pursuers, but people didn't actually do that.
She deliberately left the phone, she said, partly to herself.
She left it for us to find?
Shugtathux wobbled.
Why?
She followed through on the thought out loud. She wants to be found? Maybe she's trying to stop herself. Maybe Jessica's still got some control. Maybe she's trying to fight back. But if Jessica and her ancient were currently wrestling each other for control of the body, then a very fast way of resolving that conflict would be to let Victor Kaysin loose, to atomize first and ask questions later. Under that kind of threat, the real Jessica would probably be scared off for good. Alison glanced back and forth between the monastery and the hills to the north. The professional thing to do at that point would have been to go back to Elizabeth and Danvers and Pavani and Anderson, express her concerns, and then hope that they would rethink the situation, discuss options, and come up with a new course of action that everyone could agree upon, and additionally hope that they could manage all of this before Kaysin and Hesketh found Jessica. She turned to Dennis. You know where the other fluidics are?
Yes,
he replied, pointing his mass northwards. Can you take me to them? Quick enough to get there before a pair of professional hunters do? 76.
You know, we are occasionally referred to as professionals, said Kaysin, standing with arms folded. It wouldn't hurt to live up to it once in a while.
Hesketh's senses had led the party east through the forest, then a little way north, then back west, then sharply to the northeast. So far they had found no fluidics but a few traces of their slime trails and a great deal of salt. Adam was crouching beside a mass of the stuff that was creating a huge crescent-shaped dent in the vegetation. He sat back on his haunches.
What's the matter now?
This is taking way too long, said Victor. How long are we going to keep diddling back and forth?
Adam straightened up.
For as long as they did, I guess.
Great. And in the meantime, she's probably making fluidic slushies as we speak. Can't you get some general idea of where it's all leading?
I don't tell you how to burn things, said Adam testily. The signal's gotten spread around too much. All I can do is follow the line through the fog.
Victor punched his palm.
Christ, she's toying with us.
Adam began to walk northwest, the direction indicated by the curve of the salt barrier.
Or she was toying with them. You know, herding them.
Herding them where?
To the sea, suggested Black, following behind Victor just ahead of Rawlins. He was a young man, younger than Kaysin or Hesketh, with a pinched face that looked like he was constantly trying to determine the source of a bad smell.
No one asked you, kid, said Victor, on immediate reflex. Bet you're feeling pretty stupid about all this, hmm?
Me, said Adam, not looking back, but keeping his eyes on the invisible trails. About what?
You know, buying into Weatherby's bollocks about how demonic possession is misunderstood, and how they're really kindred spirits having a great big cosmic cuddle inside one body.
That was Aaron. Last I checked, we're looking for his sister.
I said I'm pretty sure she was herding them towards the sea, said Black. Victor made a sharp exhalation, spitting the air out of his mouth.
You don't seriously think they're not in cahoots on this one? I knew he was laying it on a bit thick. Oh, the wonderful music of the spheres in the ethereal realm, hippy-dippy, happy-clappy. Keep the dumb twats distracted while the sister's striking names off the list.
You could have mentioned your suspicions at the time.
I did! Why are we stopping?
The forest had cleared around them and transitioned into the grassy hills north of the monastery. Adam pointed towards another mass of salt in the grass ahead, a wall of spikes like the teeth of a vast, monstrous jawbone emerging from beneath the ground.
North,
said Victor, interpreting the curve of the wall.
Hmm, said Adam, inspecting the horizon. I think she might have been taking them to the sea.
Black opened his mouth.
Why would she do that? Interjected Victor.
Adam shrugged.
Lots of salt in the sea.
What, you think she needs to stock up? She's a salt elemental. She's not wanting for salt.
I don't get it either, but it's the direction they went. Maybe she's doing, like, a symbolic thing.
Casting them into the sea? Victor mulled it over. They do seem to like poetry. Had to listen to her brothers for half an hour.
Oh, God, I get it, moaned Adam, resuming the walk. You weren't taken in and you still hate possessed people. Good for you. I'm sure you'll have a lovely time hurting this one.
Yes, I'm sure I will, spat Victor. Won't you?
Actually, no, I won't.
So why do you hate fluidics so much? 77. On the coast directly north of the monastery, the last hill descended into a slope of smooth black stone that coarsened into a rocky beach as it reached the water. White waves slithered rhythmically in and out of the labyrinth of cracks and funnels between the stones, the occasional burst of spray adding a light percussion to the calming hiss of surf. The physical aspect of Jessica Weatherby stood on a large rock at the point where the tide met the land, watching the tongues of foam licking at the unyielding stone below her. Her feet were together and her hands were gathered behind her back as she looked to the horizon and took a deep, invigorating breath.
All right, troops,
she said. The ancient's presence had given her voice a high-pitched metallic ring in contrast to Aaron's booming, demonic tones.
Don't draw this out! The water's not getting any warmer!
She lifted one leg like a flamingo and spun on her heel, keeping her balance effortlessly. A vast horseshoe of conjured salt dominated the beach, its arms reaching all the way to the ocean. A patchwork quilt of shaking fluidics occupied the space in between, pressed together to escape the touch of the salt and the seawater. With each slap of the waves against the horseshoe's mouth, they squeezed each other more tightly, emitting a squeaky collective fart.
Oh, don't be such babies, we all have to learn to swim sometime,
said Jessica's mouth, as the rest of her bobbed on her ankles in anticipation.
The best way is to jump right in at the deep end, I find. It gets easier very fast.
Jessica! Allison was on the grass at the top of the slope, silhouetted against the sky. She broke into an anxious run, and as she took in the scene below, awkwardly reduced it to a slow advance, hands splayed forward calmingly. The Jessica entity replied with a loud throat noise, reminiscent of a stock wrong-answer game show buzzer.
Have another guess.
Reaver? Jessica's index finger scratched her temple.
Not bad. You've got not bad, that's safe. But if you get this question wrong, you won't go through to the final round. Who am I really?
Shinkshathux,
said Dennis, from the long grass just behind the rise. Jessica's arms stretched wide.
And the cowpat has won tonight's star prize, a beach full of dead hens. Take another step forward, Allison Arkin. And he'll get them express delivered.
Allison had already slowed to a stop at the edge of the beach as she took in Jessica's new appearance. Her dark T-shirt had become black from the moisture that seeped constantly from the pores in her grey flesh. Parts of her face had swelled and become gelatinous and semi-transparent, revealing her veins and a few stark lines of bone. The fluidics were once part of an ancient named Shugshathux, recalled Allison aloud, barely conscious of her own words, as her eyes scanned Jessica's face. We assumed Shugshathux wasn't still around. We were wrong.
I'm not giving out extra credit, but yes, you were,
said Jessica Shugshathux, doing a fashion model's twirl on the rock. The tide came in again, and a burst of salt water sprinkled across the crowd of fluidics. Each droplet left a small hole ringed with black crust, and the recipient would flinch and press even harder against the mass. Allison didn't know if fluidics could feel pain as humans understood it, but they were picking up terror like naturals. Fluidics came here as refugees, she remembered. Why didn't anyone ever ask what they were seeking refuge from? Why are you doing this? She asked. What little of Jessica's face could still express normal emotions gave her a condescending look.
Come on, silly tits. If your left leg broke off and declared independence, you'd want to make an example of it before your right leg got ideas.
They're sentient. There was another squeal as the tide pushed in again, shaving a narrow strip off the leading fluidic. Jessica's face shook with anger, making the swollen parts jiggle like molded jelly.
What is it with corporeals and sentience? It's not that special. You think you're an entire dimension of chosen ones, don't you? Swanning about in your hairy pink suits, waving your wrinkly parts for everyone to see. Let me tell you what being sentient means. Getting as shat on as everything else, but having to be aware of it. That's all.
Alison took a single step forward, palms still outstretched. I understand, she lied, but I still have to stop you. Jessica's left eyebrow lolled upwards.
You're welcome to try.
Alison tried to take another step forward, but her foot refused to move. She looked down and saw it disappearing into a miniature garden of white crystals that was bursting from the cracks between the pebbles. She pulled harder, and the end of each spike divided into pretty fractal patterns, expanding to encase her entire lower leg. The growth swiftly spread to her other foot, crossing over the top of her shoe and tightening like crystalline laces.
What a tense, climactic showdown that was,
said Jessica Shugtuthux dryly, if such a word could still be applied to anything she did. Jessica, said Alison, pronouncing the word clearly and firmly. I want to talk to Jessica, not Reva, and not Shugtuthux. Jessica Shugtuthux's back stiffened, her arms falling loosely by her sides. I know you're still there, continued Alison. The salt had stopped growing after both of her knees were held in place. And I know that you don't want this. You can fight it, Jessica. Jessica Shugtuthux swayed on her rocky perch for a moment, her eyes unfocused, before she cocked her head and put her hands on her hips.
Okay, that was embarrassing. Is that really how you think this works? Do you think in my head there's like a little Jessica and a little Shugtuthux fighting over the microphone?
She jiggled her head, and the salt crystals that encased Allison's legs grew explosively. In seconds they had risen to engulf the right side of her torso, surrounding her arm, and clamping it into place more rigidly than her cloak of squirrels had managed.
Jessica's dead,
advised Jessica Shugtuthux.
Shugtuthux is dead? All Shugtuthux's wayward kids are coming along for the ride,
Her brow resembled a wet sponge being wrung out as it furrowed with confusion. She sniffed the air as vapour began to rise from the sea around her. The gentle hum of the surf was slowly joined by a liquid thundering that grew in volume like advancing war drums. She looked down and saw that the water around her rock was boiling violently. The tide drew back to reveal softening rocks glowing yellowly with heat. "Don't let me interrupt," said Victor Kaysen, who was standing atop the rise, one hand outstretched and trench coat billowing impressively in the cool coastal breeze. You were saying something about being dead? Jessica Shugtuthux's head snapped upwards with a shower of viscous droplets.
Stay where you are,
she said, all levity vanishing.
I'll kill them all.
Victor strolled nonchalantly down the slope, outstretched arm bouncing mockingly with each step. Kill them all, and I'll roast you alive. Isn't debating fun? The rock beneath Jessica Shugtuthux shifted as it began to melt. She crouched, no longer confident in her balance, and glanced around like a nervous gazelle seeking escape. The tide came in again and threw up sheets of steam the instant it touched the glowing shingle. Victor! Yelled Alison. The tide! Victor looked away from his prey and saw the seawater rush toward the mass of fluidics again. He threw out his free hand, and a scar of red heat tore across the mouth of the horseshoe. The salt water evaporated completely before it touched any part of the fluidic's cringing mass. Adam! He barked. Get them out of there! Adam Hesketh appeared from behind his partner and galloped wobblingly ahead, descending the slope at a sprint that seemed to be threatening to turn into a catastrophic fall all the way down. He practically collapsed against the wall of the salt horseshoe and began pulling at it with his hands to make a gap. Victor froze, which was probably ironic. Where's she gone? Adam looked up. The steam had cleared to reveal that Jessica Shugtuthux's perch was little more than a misshapen orange lump, rapidly cooling in the surrounding water, but she herself was nowhere to be seen. He switched on his enhanced vision and immediately pointed to a spot in the ocean several yards to the right of where she was last seen. She's under the water, there? He was indicating quite a large swathe of the Atlantic Ocean, so Victor erred on the side of caution. A section of sea floor the size of a modest car park began to glow. Bubbles soon rose to the surface, followed by a number of dead fish. Jessica Shugtuthux exploded from the water on a narrow ridge of salt, clinging to its top with all her limbs like a motorcycle rider. Her mutated face was twisted with fury, and she focused it all on the first enemy she saw, which happened to be Adam Hesketh. A thick line of salt burst from her perch, extending all the way from the sea to the top of the beach, slicing through the horseshoe like the line through a scent symbol.
Adam dived aside, and the fluidics separated into two groups to avoid it. Two of them weren't quick enough, and were lifted high off the ground, shriveling rapidly at the salt's deadly touch. Victor melted the salt directly underneath Jessica Shukshuthuk's, and the ridge collapsed, sending her tumbling into the sea, along with several gobbets of molten salt that burst and spat violently as they touched the water. Stunned, she was dumped unceremoniously onto the beach by the tide, where she lay coughing into the shingle. The pale and semi-transparent parts of her exposed flesh had turned raw pink from the heat. Victor began to advance towards her, aiming both hands squarely at her head. She saw him coming, and threw a hand towards him. Salt crystals materialized between his splayed fingers, and an instant later, both his hands were trapped inside textured spheres resembling giant golf balls. As he inspected them, bemused, a third growth of salt crystals ensnared both of his feet. Her arms slapped back down, exhausted, and she hung her head with relief. "Pyrokinetic," said Victor. She looked up again, blinking in the sun.
"What?"
"I'm a pyrokinetic. I start fires with my mind." Jessica Shuchithix glanced around, trying to figure out the punchline.
I know what pyrokinetic means.
"With my mind," repeated Victor, emphasizing each word. "Not with my hands." He punctuated his sentence by making the salt around his feet glow, then burst as he hopped out of it before it could burn his legs. Jessica Shukshuthuk made an animalistic growl and pushed herself away from the rapidly heating stones beneath her. She crab-walked back into the shallows, throwing out wild conjurations of salt behind her that Victor melted leisurely as he sloshed towards her, leaving a trail of bursts and sputters where molten salt reacted with the water. Finally, her strength gave out, and she flopped down onto her back, only her face breaking the surface of the water. Victor seized his chance and closed the distance, standing directly over her, with one of his salt mittens over her head.
"Please,"
said Jessica Shuchithux, between gasping breaths. Victor didn't move. Allison tensed, waiting for Jessica's skull to be vaporized at any moment, but it never happened. She peered at Victor as best she could, and saw that an internal conflict seemed to be raging in the battleground of his furrowing brow and twitching mouth. A blunt column of salt erupted from the sea between Victor's legs and buried itself in his crotch, with a sound like a sack of flour hitting a concrete floor. He bent double just as Jessica Shuchithuk sat up, grabbed his coat by the lapels, and pulled him into a somersault that left him lying on his back in the shallows. She conjured a solid belt of salt around his midsection before he could react, pinning him to the sea floor. He growled and started melting the salt, but an incoming wave smashed across his face and went up his mouth and nostrils, killing his concentration. By the time he had shaken that off, Jessica Shuchithuk was walking ponderously back up the beach, shoulders squared. "Hey!" he yelled. "We're not done!"
"Salt elemental?"
replied Jessica Shuchithuk, not looking back. "What?"
"I'm a salt elemental. I create salt. I don't create shits to give."
Victor growled again, and made another attempt to melt the salt that held him in place. He had made a small piece of it glow before the water came in again and cooled it rapidly. Something painful and fast-moving burst off and stung his cheek, narrowly missing his eye socket. Adam had been able to clear a space in the section of salt prison nearest the water, and three fluidics had already squeezed through to safety. Jessica Shukshuthuk threw up an arm without slowing her pace, and another ring of salt appeared, turning the circle of salt and seawater into more of a Venn diagram, enclosing all the fluidics anew. The salt bank sprouted a few small extensions that encased Adam's hands and feet. When everyone was secure, Jessica Shuchithuk half-collapsed onto the nearest bank of salt, resting her arms on her knees and hanging her head. Heaving great breaths rocked her entire torso.
"Why are you doing this?" asked Adam,
struggling against the crystals that held his limbs.
"She already asked that?"
panted Jessica Shuchthuk, jerking a thumb towards Allison before her arm fell back down loosely.
"Sum it up for the latecomers?"
Something in Adam's voice made her look up. The grassy rise above the beach had become decorated with several new silhouettes, some holding cameras to their faces.
"Hey, guys,"
she said, pointing at the nearest cluster of fluidics, who cringed away from her hand in fear.
"You know not to come any closer, right?" "Yeah, you do. You're smart."
Her head dropped again, the effort of speaking exhausting her anew.
"So why?"
pressed Adam.
You didn't think to ask these questions before boiling me alive,
she said quietly.
You'd have looked very silly if I'd had a sane reason.
Well, she straightened up and almost fell backwards off her perch before a slab of salt rose up behind her, turning her seat into an armchair. She leant comfortably against the backrest and eyed the row of journalists.
So you're listening to Aaron Bjarkton's set back there? Do you want to hear about the big detail he left out?
There was a flutter of cameras being readjusted and recording devices being checked, the equivalent of the enthusiastic tail wag of a dog being promised a treat.
It's shit,
said Jessica Shugshuthux, after an appropriately dramatic pause.
The ethereal realm is an entire dimension of shit. No stars, no planets, no cities, no interstellar bum pirates, just shit. Great drifting masses of shit. Solid shit, liquid shit, shit clouds, all the colours of the rainbow and beyond, but it's still shit. And it's the worst kind of shit. Shit that's gotten smart enough to think that it isn't shit.
Her gaze dropped again. Everyone else was utterly silent. Even the noise of the surf seemed to have quietened, although the fluidics emitted another nervous fart each time the tide brushed close. A confused look was doing the rounds among the journalists.
And when all there is shit, shit is the only thing that matters,
continued Jessica Shugshuthux, apparently addressing the floor.
All those vast cosmic minds, and all they do is fight over shit. For no reason. Tear enough dingleberries off the others, and maybe you'll build up enough to be king shit of Turd Mountain for a while. But sooner or later, the others pull you apart, and you're back to square one. It's like building shit castles on quicksand, made of shit.
She seemed to notice for the first time the fluidics huddled at the foot of her salt throne.
Yeah, you're all a bunch of little shits, too,
she said.
But you are my shit, and when shit's the only thing you've got, you can't afford to get a reputation as someone who can't hold their shit.
Jessica, please just let them go, said Allison, three of her limbs still immobilized. I know you still got some control. Jessica Shugshuthux jumped up as if her chair had become electrified and it immediately dissolved into granules.
I thought the corporeal realm was a bit lighter on the shit, but your skull must be full of it. We went over this.
But I know you do. Allison's last remaining free hand waved a smartphone. You left your phone for us to find, so we would know what was going on, right? Jessica Shugshuthux patted her pockets, rolled her eyes, then walked over to Allison, carelessly treading on fluidics as she went. The salt in the tread of her shoes left black footprints in their quivering forms.
Must have dropped it. Thanks for bringing it back.
You dropped it to send a message. You wanted to be found, and stopped. Jessica put her face an inch from Allison's, snatching the phone rudely from her hand.
Duh, I wanted to be found. What's the point of all this if no one sees it? I just assumed stealing all your favourite turds would be enough to make you come looking. Not because I forgot my...
She looked down.
Wait, this isn't mine.
Ounge, went the rune-crafting app on Diablerie's smartphone. Ounge, 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 ounge. Baffled, Jessica Shugshuthux held the device at arm's length until the sound of the chant grew slurred and distant. Both she and Allison felt pressure descend upon their shoulders like a thick blanket, and a ringing in their ears as millions of magical particles were drawn in like the slow inhalation of a sleeping dragon. The two of them made eye contact, then simultaneously looked down. The Aunch rune was a simple one, consisting only of three interconnecting lines, a conflux of angles that recurred several hundred times in the crystalline salt clusters that Jessica Shugshuthux had created. Every single one of those recurrences was now intensifying, distorting their surroundings with an effect similar to a heat haze. Something very loud and very violent happened. 78. After these events, when Allison was in a combination of recuperation and quarantine, Archibald Brooke Stodgley visited her and explained precisely what had happened at that moment, while helping himself to about 20 of the grapes Shugshuthux had brought.
As I'm sure you'll remember, the I won't actually say it, but you know, that rune you incanted, it means push. There's a very good reason why sensible runecrafters would only use it as part of a sequence. push is very interpretive. You need to specify push upwards this or that distance to create the wall, or push sound outwards to create silence. What you were doing, my dear, in casting it by itself, was, in layman's terms, saying, surprise me. You were telling each magic particle to decide for itself what you meant, in terms of what to push, where to push it, and with what force. And that's broadly why you're now in a hospital bed, and why the video of your experiment has hit several million views online.
It was only from watching the news footage of the incident later that Alison determined the precise events, as all she knew at the time was that something confusing and painful happened. Her salt restraints had shattered instantly, sending both her and Jessica Shugjathuks spinning into the air like ragdolls, before they had both landed with wince-inducing force. Alison had deliberately kept the volume of the chant low to keep the effect as local as possible, but even so, a crater half the size of a tennis court appeared in the shingle. Salt and stones went flying, and the fluidics caught in the radius were all instantly flattened into half-inch thick pancakes to no long-term ill effect. Some commenters attested that the tide momentarily ran in reverse. Pain fluttered through Alison's back from a thousand different starting points as she writhed in the pebbles, keeping her eyes shut while she felt around and determined that all her limbs and organs were in their appropriate places. When she finally looked, she was staring straight up the slope to the top of the rise, where, among the blurry silhouettes of onlookers, she could see the blurry silhouette of a man in a top hat. He threw out a hand as if in greeting, and Alison felt a length of something light drop onto her chest. Still woozy, she squinted at it, and saw the familiar symbols of the dispel sequence. It was the same rune circle Diablerie had used to pacify the squirrels back in Doncaster. Her focus shifted to Jessica Shugjathuks. She was a few yards ahead, sprawled against the side of one of her salt barriers, struggling to lift herself onto her elbows. Alison made to get up. Her joints registered several wobbling complaints immediately, but she was able to get enough of her limbs on board to start moving. She half staggered, half crawled the short distance, and threw the rune circle around Jessica Shugjathuks, almost collapsing on top of her with the effort. Diablerie's runecrafting phone was lying a few feet away, silent and deactivated. Evidently the push command had also been applied to the mute button. Alison picked it up, and with her fingers stiff and shaking, arduously keyed in the dispel sequence. Jessica Shugjathuks had gotten as far as supporting herself on one elbow. She looked back with difficulty, the gelatinous tissue around her eyes clouded with blood.
Alison?
Alison held out the phone like a police detective presenting their credentials as the eerily calm voice began to chant. At first, Jessica Shugjathuks just stared, jaw hanging in bafflement as she tried to focus on the tiny screen. Eventually she scraped together enough thinking power to draw a connection between the phone talking and terrible things happening shortly afterwards, but by then it was too late. She was able to drag herself a princely 2 inches before the magic took hold. The chant began to sit thickly on the ear canals. The symbols on the circle darkened and deepened. Jessica's body flopped down as if an invisible elephant had stepped into the middle of the rune circle. Her body shivered in spasm, then went limp. The semi-transparent regions of her mutated flesh clouded over like milk being dropped into water. Her skin tone slowly shifted from grey-white to a conventional human paleness, embellished with red grazes and purple bruises. Only then did Alison turn off the chant. She collapsed where she stood, landing in a sitting position, and stared at the ground between her knees. The runecrafting phone hung loosely from her hand. Adam coughed.
Before you get comfortable, I think Victor might be drowning.
79. Soon, Alison added another new experience to a day full of them, the experience of not being able to remember something. She had freed Adam, then sat down again as he had splashed off into the tide to free Victor, and everything after that was lost. She must have blacked out, unless someone with a teleportation power had been passing by. The next thing she knew, she was lying in a hospital bed in a warm, lemon-coloured room, with sunlight streaming in between flower-patterned curtains. There were 3 other beds, 2 vacant. With her mattress tilted forward and a generous pile of pillows propping up her head and shoulders, Alison could do nothing but stare at the occupant of the opposite bed.
It was Jessica Weatherby, in hospital pyjamas. Not Jessica Shugshathuk's. The swollen, gelatinous flesh had been replaced with the slight puffiness of bruising.
"Jessica?" said Allison.
Her eyes were open, and she was breathing, so it was probably safe to assume she was alive, but there was nothing alive about her vacant stare, or the way she drew air in and out of her lungs as mechanically as a machine. She had even more pillows than Allison, probably to stop her neck from lolling too far. Allison was helpless to do anything but take in Jessica's appearance for what felt like an hour, before the door briefly opened to admit Richard Danvers, along with the sound of bustling nurses and orderlies in the corridor outside.
"Oh, good, you're awake," he sighed. "That's something, at least."
His choice of words did nothing to dull her growing sense of impending woe. "Mr. Danvers," she said, but something caught in her throat, and she interrupted herself with a cough.
"Focus on resting for now," he said, coming to her side.
Again, his choice of the words "for now" undermined his advice. "You're in a private hospital that the department has an arrangement with."
"Is Jessica going to be all right?"
Danvers looked at the opposite bed, then to the floor, then back to Allison.
"First, let me say that I completely understand what you were trying to do."
He was 0 for 3 on reassurances so far.
"What happened? You thought by using that magical cancelling device you could pacify her, right? Perhaps even reverse the possession."
He shrugged. "Archibald's coming down soon to run some tests, so he'll be able to explain it better. But as I understand it, it's like a cancerous organ. You can't take out the cancer without taking the organ with it."
Allison couldn't stop staring at Jessica. The vacant stare seemed to take on an accusatory note.
"She's been brainwashed?"
"More wiped than washed, really," said Danvers.
He winced at Allison's expression.
"For what it's worth, it might have been the best option. She might have killed all those fluidics at any moment."
"Yeah," said Allison, pretending to be convinced. Internally, she appended the words, "but she didn't."
"What happens now?"
Danvers hugged his torso and blew out his lungs, as if he were trying to squeeze the air out of himself with his hands.
"I really don't know.
Anderson set up a meeting with Elizabeth first thing in the morning. I know, because he did so at full volume.
Do you think he'll shut down the department?"
"Personally, I think things could have gone a lot worse," said Danvers, with a politician's skill for simultaneously dodging and answering the question.
"There may be some changes in store."
He scrutinized her.
"You were originally hired for secrecy reasons, yes? Is there any reason you couldn't go back to your family now?"
This was it. This was the moment Allison had been dreading, from the moment the ministry had become the department and abandoned all secrecy. Every morning for the first few weeks she had woken twisted with anxiety at the thought that today might be the day. That Elizabeth, or Danvers, or someone else, asked her the killer question, "Why are you still here?" After months of running from office to filing room to coffee machine, she thought she had become essential enough a part of the department's background noise for the matter to be closed.
Danvers read her expression.
"Family," he said sympathetically. He looked away as anger brought a hint of a twitch to his upper lip.
"Like I said, just rest for now. There'll be updates soon."
Allison made no response, but continued mimicking the blank stare of her roommate. Danvers sighed, got up, and went to the door.
"Visitors for you,"
he announced, as he slipped past them and away.
The visitors were Adam Hesketh in his usual black ensemble, pushing Dennis the Fluidic in a wheeled plastic conveyance, apparently for hygiene's sake.
There was a plastic punnet of white grapes sitting on top of the pile of Dennis.
"We brought grapes,"
he said, needlessly, as he passed them into her hands with an adept shifting of his upper mass. He had evidently made an effort to avoid digesting the gift, but there was a thin film of dampness over it regardless. She tactfully placed it on the bedside table.
"I was checking on Victor," said Adam casually. "Ran into Shugshathuk's in the hall, so I thought I'd tag along and see how you were doing, you know, while I'm here."
"Oh," said Allison distantly.
Adam's casual tone dropped instantly.
"I mean, not that I wouldn't have come to visit if Victor hadn't been here too. I just wouldn't want you to think..."
Allison came to the rescue as he began to stammer.
"How's Victor?"
"Good. He didn't drown."
He chewed on his lip for a moment, thinking of what else to reveal.
"They're keeping him under observation for a bit. He's got heightened possession risk."
He made finger quotes. Allison frowned. I thought you and he couldn't get possessed any more. He waggled a hand.
You can get back on the Ancients' radar if you use too much power in one go. It's not likely at all, but it has happened. Actually, that's a big part of why the Ministry was formalized in the 19th century. Some people were trying to exploit magic users